Hello, Klaus Moosmeyer, for the RegTech Impact podcast. I'm really happy that you enjoy us. I want to start with some questions, but let me start with the question, who are you and what are you doing?
Yeah, Ken, hello. Hope everything is well on your side. Big pleasure and honor to be in your podcast. Yeah, look, how would I describe myself? I'm a compliance, ethics, risk, and compliance professional, and hopefully also leader in the meantime in my leadership journey. I'm working now over 20 years in the battlefield of ethics, risk, and compliance, starting as a lawyer. Then 18 years at Siemens, also have been the chief compliance officer at Siemens years. And then joined 2 years ago our Novartis of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world as member of the executive committee and the chief ethics, risk, and compliance officer. But maybe even more important, I'm a husband and a father of three grown-up kids now in the meantime. German Spanish family, and family is always first priority, of course.
Of course, I think in Corona times, family gets more important.
Absolutely. We remember what really matters to us and what are the real values we should protect.
Absolutely. And I think you have children, you mean by the time digitalization is also important topics. And that is something we are going to talk a little bit. I
Yeah,
mean,
good.
if you talk about RegTech, what were your first contacts with the RegTech industry? Do you have any contacts with RegTechs?
Yeah, look, I mean, first of all, I have to admit I'm not a digital native, so I am a learner in this whole and in the years of my professional career. Interesting enough, I mean, as a younger lawyer, the first link to RegTech or to technology in the field of regulatory rules, laws was in the early 2000s, when we implemented at Siemens the Sarbanes-Oxley framework, and I was a member of the task force there as a lawyer. And this was the first, I mean, really linked to which systems, IT systems, can we use? What about data quality, data analytics? How should this be implemented into the company IT system, especially for control over funds? This was the first connect, I would say, in the early 2000s.
It was the first time you heard the word RegTech, although in 2000, or that's new for
No,
you.
that's new for me. I mean, I must admit, as I mean, I'm now very much, of course, involved in these discussions, as you can imagine. But RegTech for me, I must admit it bluntly, it came up in the last couple of years as a broader understanding. So how I would understanding, but you correct me if I'm wrong, would be putting the best what technology has to offer in the context of compliance and risk, and specifically that's maybe the next step, also involving the ethical and cultural dimension. But you tell me if I'm completely on the wrong way here.
I mean, it's like define the of defining of corruption is difficult. It's
Yeah.
the same like RegTech. I mean, at RegTech Impact, we define RegTech like RegTech describes the use of modern computer-based digital technologies to automate is one point, to simplify second, and improve regulatory governance, fraud, compliance, anti-corruption, ethical and risk tasks. And this is a very holistic approach. If we talk about RegTech for almost 5 years, everybody ta talks about fintech, and RegTech is a subtech of fintech. But in our definition, it's more like you can do it on fintech area, like maybe you heard about MR Risk, some for
Of course,
example, and all the things. But in this case, and this is also one of my aim or vision of RegTech Impact, to do not only fintech stuff, to do more in pharma, do in healthcare, where we can do really RegTech, or we can say things like computer-based digital technologies to improve and to simplify and automate. And that is a really another view, I think. And that is where we want to talk, because normally if I talk with RegTech, it's always fintech, and that is not the best way, I think. What is your opinion about that? I mean,
no, absolutely, it's an evolution, and I fully agree. It started with fintech, and this is where we know it. But as the whole, the whole system is evolving. The regulatory system is evolving on the public side, and then also on the private side. I mean, again, Erkan, now during COVID-19. This is a no-brainer, and the public side has to accelerate the digital journey on the regulatory side. I mean, just for an example, the pharmaceutical industry, during lockdown times, authorities can't do inspections on manufacturing sites anymore for pharmaceutical companies. So just imagine now the public inspection has to be done digital to fulfill the regulatory requirements. That's a completely new way of doing things.
Mm-hmm. And also, you can do a lot of things not the right way. I mean, you have to save, for example, if you're checking your supplier by data, for example, and you have to get the information and you have to clarify that. And clarifying, because on data, you can do a lot of things. You can make fraud, for example, but you have to check that. And for example, the technology is very interesting, but nobody used it. For example, you can check, for example, it's just an example, it's not data protection. You have to be a little bit careful. Via photos, for example, you can check if the person is living there. For example, he's telling you he is living in this area, but you can check with photos, or you check by another workflows. And that is something we think we should think about. Absolutely, I think.
You're absolutely right. And we are applying this again strictly, of course, for the rules of data privacy, the legal rules, and we can discuss the ethical challenges in a second, but just imagine a market like China, where we have a lot of interactions, transactions, the public sector, education programs, which are important in the pharmaceutical world for the peer-to-peer education for the doctors. But of course, you have to document them the right way. And we're also using photos, as you said, as an evidence for this. And we can see that you can also try to fake the photos, and that you fake meetings and try to start a fraud scheme. And that's a very interesting topic, especially now, and the question how you can develop your monitoring, your audit skills and functions to keep up with this. That's top of our minds, I would say.
I think we are really deeply in the matter of technology, but we can go one step back. As you establish companies, what should RegTechs learn or consider working better with established companies, or even to win them as customers? Because on the one hand, RegTechs have to do two things. They have to do a pitch at established companies, and the other hand, they have to pitch at the regulatories, for example, BaFin, we can say that here in Germany, for example. And how we can help them to do better working with established companies? Is there a way?
I think it's a learning journey, to be honest. And one comment on this learning journey is the ideal situation for us with the RegTech companies is that they have they see both. First of all, they keep the startup kind of attitude to think outside the box, because this is what we need as established companies. Someone who thinks outside the box and has the external perspective. On the other hand, the second point, Erkan, is really understand our context in which we are working from a technology landscape point of view. We often see companies approaching us and they want to sell us a maybe wonderful system for ethics, risk, and compliance, but they just have no idea about our IT landscape, about the context we are working. And then you know it does not simply fit together, because we can only implement given the situation of our IT landscape and our technology roadmap. And if this is not common understanding, the learning, a joint learning, it simply makes no sense. We can't buy an isolated solution which is not fitting to our system. But keep the startup mindset when it comes to innovation out of the box.
I mean, can I say API technology is very important. I mean, APIs that you can not isolate, or you can integrate into the IT landscape. That is a very important thing on RegTech, and everybody use that. I mean, keeping up with startup attitude, it's very important. But on the other hand, we're talking about business, and you have to make money of that. And that is something what I can say. To invest in RegTech is very expensive. As I told you, you have got two customers. One is the regulator, and the other hand, your customer. And that is something I try to figure out how we can help them. But this is a good point. Keep up startup and really knowing what you do. And that makes talk with the people, I think, before you doing that. I mean, one of the failure for startups is they do something which the market don't need.
Absolutely. The listening, I mean, we all listen, we're not listening enough, also as leaders sometimes. So that's an important topic. And listening is for RegTech, I think, very important, because look, we are big companies. We are hilariously complex, of course. And you have to understand this. That's the journey.
Go we to the another question. What I want to know: any recommendation to how established companies and RegTechs can be actively engaged in fighting, for example, against corruption? I mean, we have an example: corruption. And how we can do that? I mean, on the one hand, we have startups. They want to do something against corruption. Do you have something like a sandbox? By meaning sandbox is you don't think about the technology landscape. You just try it in a safety environment. That's something?
Yeah. The sandbox exercise gets increasing traction, I would say, in companies and also on international level. I'm also engaged at business at OECD as a member of the executive board there. We are just doing, as we speak, a sandbox exercise together with the OECD on data privacy and data and digital. And we also involved there our chief data privacy officer, is also part of this exercise. And we're also, to a certain extent, trying the sandbox approach in companies. So joint efforts are key. And there are platforms. I want to give you one example where we made a request for public-private partnership. We have the B20 process at the moment in Saudi Arabia. That's the mirror of the G20 process. I'm one of the co-chairs for the Compliance Integrity Task Force. And one of our big recommendations is to use emerging technology in the fight against corruption and have a public-private partnership for joint sandbox processes. And for example, develop a global value chain passport, digital passport for companies to have beneficial ownership transparency across the globe if you come to supply chain to fight corruption. So we made a pledge, to G20 leaders to start this kind of public-private partnership in the sandbox area, and we need direct companies to join this.
Absolutely. It's a good idea, sandboxes, because you need a playing field, and I think without having too much damage. On the other hand, it should be not only staying on the sandbox, it should be go live version, but it's the first step, I would say.
Yeah.
I recommend
that. Yeah.
If you go one question, what do you think established companies do better in companies' tasks than 5 years ago? I mean, we took too much about startups, but still look to the companies, what they do better in compliance than 5 years ago.
Yeah, I would say we are in the journey from just putting data together, structured data together with this, as you know, as an expert, it's the first step, you need structured data before you start analyzing. The companies have put together a huge amount of data. And the The first focus in the last 5 years, I would say, was more on the forensic detection side. We are now seeing the big benefit to go to using the data for reporting mechanisms and for predictive analytics. That's the big thing, I believe. We're not there yet, definitely not. But the one thing is detection, and the one thing is prediction. And don't underestimate this for huge companies. We're all looking for assurance models. And one important topic for assurance is how do you report real-time data to the governing bodies like executive committee, the board. And this is exactly the journey we are in. From just putting together big data and using them for detection to come to reporting mechanisms and starting about predictive analytics, which is in the early days. But on reporting, I would say we are much better than 5 years ago. I have a global dashboard I can use where I get data overviews from the whole organization. I didn't have this 5 years ago.
Right. Yes. That means to sum it up, you have got predictive analytics and detecting and reporting. And if we talk about reporting, you mean also internal reporting, also external reporting, both sides.
Both, yeah, because we are, and as you raised topic the pharmaceutical industry, we are one of the regulated, therefore RegTech is important industries which have to report a lot. I mean, we have to report under various laws around the globe about our transfer of value, what we pay, for example, to healthcare practitioners for conferences, for speaker programs, for peer-to-peer education, being part of our clinical trials, and so on and so forth. And this is external reporting, transparency laws, but also the internal reporting for our assurance needs we have in companies.
Perfect. But what is your view on the fast-changing technology landscape in today's world? I mean, technology changes, and what is your opinion about that?
Yeah. I mean, this is a big clash, I would say, of the potential we see, and which is maybe already working, especially if you see what's all possible under COVID-19 circumstances now. And so the opportunities and also the risks. I mean, if you think about the data privacy concept we have, is this the future of really individual consent? Is this still possible in this fast-changing world, or do we need a different approach, especially if we come to data which benefits research and development in health, patient data, which is a big, of course, topic. Patient data has to be protected and used only for specific purposes. But it's not for marketing, it's for research and development. So what kind of consent regime will we find in these days? And ethical dilemmas, how we use RegTech and for data analytics and data mining. I mean, there are companies out, you know, who have a high profile, are highly criticized sometimes, but also highly effective if it comes to bring data sources together. So I believe this ethical questions, data privacy questions, they will increase, and we are working on this also.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's like the example, you know, Google Maps, for example, with the data protection is you pay them with your data, but everybody use that.
Yep.
And that is something, it's a good example, I think, that you are on the one hand on data protection, on the other hand, the use of that. That is something which we're thinking is an important part. By the way, I think the government are going to do more in ethical things, like doing standards for ethical. For example, I know in AI area, there's a report about standards in ethical. But I think this is a topic ethical for a new podcast.
Absolutely.
But still on technology, what are the three major upcoming trends for you in context of risk, ethics, and compliance?
Yeah, I would say the first trend is getting out of the silos if it comes to data and digital. So the first trend, I would say, is, and for the first time now, that I really see this in practice. The trend is working across all stakeholder groups in ethics, risk, and compliance, and jointly define key metrics which are needed. Normally, you know, in the past, the functions have done this in their silos and use the data in their silos. But the first trend is this kind of holistic across different functions working on data and digital. The second one is an increased use of analytics. So data analytics, not only to put data together for nice dashboards and get data visualized in a hopefully user-friendly way, but the analytics which show the user, look, this is the trend, this is the red flag, proactively you have to watch out. And this is, of course, linked to this user-centric, user-friendly movement as a second trend we need to have. And then the third one is the broad, what we see in the company. And, you know, data and digital is one of our key strategic priorities at Novartis, because we see this as a third point, as a cultural trend. It's not only technology and user-friendliness, it's the question, the cultural trend with digitalization. So upscaling, including myself, the associates to be able to use this and to drive this and to understand this on a day-to-day basis. So again, it's the three things is working across silos, going to analytics user-friendly, and third one, culturally empower the organization to make use of it. Yeah, these are the three things I see there at the moment.
I think culture is a, how would you define culture? I mean, data privacy and culture is a difficult question. I mean, can you try to define the culture? Yeah. I mean, it's
the
maybe
culture, two elements maybe. The one is, I mean, the millennials we have in the companies of in the company, they are digital natives, and they do it as it said, as digital natives. You don't have to push them there. The cultural topic is more on the topic you raised or we discussed a minute ago about where the limits, the ethics. What should we not do? Where are the red lines, which is for a pharmaceutical company, which deals with humans, of course, of great importance. Mm-hmm. But the culture, you know, in the company is also to get the fear out of the others who are not digital natives, that they really lose the fear to work with data and digital, to embrace this. Also, give you an example on manufacturing sites and elsewhere. So where people are not used to do this in a holistic way. So it's depending on your focus group, the culture, it's getting the fear out. On the other hand, for the ones who are very advanced, also to show them the ethical limits we need to respect as a company. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Quite a difficult topic, by the way.
Yeah. I know, and it's like a collective programming of the mind, I would say. I mean, that it's something what you say also. I mean, you know the limits, the red flags, and the person, or it's more the collective programming of the mindset, I think. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. It's a, but again, the collective program of the mindset, there are different groups you have to address. And not everyone is a digital native. And there are different needs on the education. And we see this in the company. So when we, as this is one of our priorities, and we have a chief digital officer in the executive committee with Bertrand Botzen, a guy who's really, really driving this, full focus on the digital journey. But you have different user groups. And you need to balance this cultural change depending on the needs and on the progress they made in the digital.
A good question, but let me think about risk management and compliance function. I think we are able to transform that in the digital age. All parties of the global ecosystems, I mean public and private, should work together. And who, I think, globally are taking the lead in this? Who can get the lead?
Yeah, I would say it's a bumpy journey, to be honest, because already the agreement that the fight against corruption needs to be a joint one between public and private sector is still not under debate, but it still needs convincing all involved parties. I mean, we are much better, to be honest, than maybe 10 years ago. In the meantime, we have joint platforms for the public and private sector. The G20 process is one, the OECD is another, United Nations has certain platforms. Also on money laundering, there are joint working groups between public and private sector. And of course, you know, this money laundering, transparency, digital topics are key. But this is still it's still something we always have to drive. And then, and this is what we try to do this year in the G20 process in Saudi Arabia, is to say we need a lighthouse project, private-public partnership on at least one or two digital projects to fight against corruption. Because only if you have a living example, the people will buy in. And this global value chain passport, which we developed at OECD, that we say a company has a digital passport, and there's the company information in there. And if you are a supplier, maybe if you use blockchain technology, you can use the passport to avoid a duplicated due diligence, because it was already done by another company, for example. And then this can be used for public tenders, to be admitted to public tenders. That, you know, for example, the ownership of the company is, the beneficial ownership is in the digital passport. And then the public tender can accept the company as a bidder with integrity, a transparent bidder. But there you need a full collaboration between the public and private sector. And the call is out, Erkan, but we are not there yet.
Yes, I think we have still work and one step behind. I mean, it's good that we do our step forwards, but still going more steps in the future, I think. And how can Novartis help to build a bridge between digital technology and compliance frameworks, especially for RegTech startups? Can Novartis help for RegTechs? Is there?
Yeah, what is help? I mean, we are quite open to share publicly our learnings and lessons on the journey. I mean, we are trying to really embrace this for our holistic ethics, risk, and compliance approach. And we have one also publicly known example. We have teamed up with other pharmaceutical companies. Bayer is one of them, to develop a joint blockchain approach for supplier due diligence in our part of our third-party risk management. And we try to engage other pharmaceutical companies to showcase that if we want to level the playing field, we need, of course, respecting the antitrust laws, to work together. And blockchain could be not the only technology, but could be a way to get this. We worked there together, Erkan, with also the universities. We had students in the project to develop this. So we tried really to bring academia and business together on this, and only as an example, on this blockchain supplier due diligence approach. And that's one of the topics we want to try out and hope to get more traction from the public side and by other pharmaceutical companies.
I understand. But I think you do something and you are open-minded for good ideas. Can I sum it up?
Yeah, absolutely. On the other hand, to be very honest, I mean, on a daily basis, we get offers from companies to support us, also commercial offers, and we see this huge interest of companies to support us there, but also ask them for understanding. We have also, as a big company, limited capabilities now, take everyone on board. We have to prioritize on this. But I see the huge appetite, not only in our company, I see this across the industry for this, and therefore this, when you started the podcast, this issue, what should RegTech companies know? This dialogue is so important that we understand each other.
I think in the beginning you told the digital mind and knowing really well the IT framework, you told us. I mean, or the topics. That was two things that RegTech should think about. We talk about RegTech, but we talk also about compliance. And is compliance job still attractive? I mean, especially because of economic consequence of the corona crisis. What do you think about the future of compliance jobs? Because
Yeah, I mean, let's face the reality. There will be budget constraints for all functions in companies who are affected by the crisis, and nearly everyone is affected by the crisis to one way or the other way. So there will be, of course, constraints. I see this, and I always say this quite loudly at all conferences I am, I see this more as an opportunity if the compliance colleagues are courageous. And it means you have to leave your... You have to go out to your from this anti-corruption corner in the company and to be willing to take on broader responsibilities for ethics, risk management, and compliance. I believe there's a big need for a holistic assurance approach in companies, especially under COVID. Leaner setup, but joint, bringing the risk topics together with compliance. And there, I believe the compliance officers, given their proven track record in risk management, they are often good communicators. They can take a lead there, but they have to be courageous to get out of their anti-corruption corner as anti-corruption specialists. They have to have a broader mindset as risk leaders and understanding data and digital and the RegTech environment.
Can I tell or sum it up like compliance experts should be more compliance leaders?
That's the journey. I mean, the compliance officer, when I started in compliance many years ago, the compliance officer was a police officer basically sitting in the company, and it was really he or she an expert. And we are on a good way to develop the compliance function. Someone who is partnering with the business, having the necessary independence, of course, but partnering, understand the business. We get many colleagues from the business in our ethics, risk, and compliance function, by the way. We have, by the way, also superb IT colleagues in the compliance organization. And you need this kind of diverse education and background in ethics, risk, and compliance. I'm a lawyer, but I don't want to have only lawyers in the compliance organization. I want to have people from sales, from the IT department, from procurement, from finance to have a holistic view, right? And this is this leadership journey and development journey from pure anti-corruption to compliance to an ethics, risk, and compliance setup.
It means for people who wanted to do a good job in compliance in the future, which professional skills will become increasingly important for risk managers or compliance managers? What would you say? What do you recommend for the people who are going to want to work in this area?
Yeah. I mean, we can build on what we discussed so far. And first of all, I think you will agree there is everyone needs to be open as a learner for data and digital. I mean, this is absolutely necessary. And I myself, I'm a learner in this because I repeat this, I'm not a digital native. So this is absolutely, absolutely key. And then I don't care about the professional background. For me, the skills are important and the intrinsic motivation for ethics, risk, and compliance. I believe we need people who are willing to develop are constant learners also in digital. Therefore, we offer at Novartis, we have an own Ethics, Risk and Compliance Academy, where we offer not only professional skills, also soft skills, communication and our cultural journey. So, and then this intrinsic motivation, you know, to do things differently and engage in these difficult, often dilemma situations of ethics, risk and compliance. So openness, data and digital interest, at least, intrinsic motivation to work in ethics, risk, and compliance are much more important than having a law degree or to be an accountant or a controller. It can be, but it's not precondition.
Good. I think almost to the end, one point, ethical dilemma. We wanted to think, talk some thoughts about your ethical dilemma in according to RegTech situation. I mean, this is one topic we should think about or talk about.
Yeah. And there are a lot. I mean, it starts, of course, with the question you raised where you said we could have a known podcast about it. If you employ more and more artificial intelligence, where are the ethical boundaries if you use them? Who is at the end the decision maker in an ethical dilemma? Is this the algorithm or is this still a human brain? What about, that is a big topic, was a big topic for our new code of ethics, which is based on behavioral science. Our own internal biases we have are often mirrored in artificial intelligence, because the people who programmed the algorithm brought their own biases into the algorithm. So, for example, you notice, if you have a recruiting tool in place, screening all the applications based on algorithms, what came out in many companies was that the algorithm preferred white male candidates, not diverse candidates. How does this come? This comes because the people who programmed this brought their own biases into the algorithm and was duplicated. So these are ethical dilemmas we definitely have, and we have them in the pharmaceutical industry as we are dealing with patients, of course, all the time.
I think this affects also the culture, and that is something. If you have recruiting by screening and only white collar, I say, this could be changing or be cultural thing. I mean, affecting the culture. Although I think, I mean, it's like a progress, and that is something. I think ethical dilemma is very important for the companies.
Absolutely.
More.
Absolutely. And we try to bring now together with our human resources organization these topics already in the recruitment process. We call this hiring with integrity, because we believe we need to bring these ethical dilemmas already in the recruitment process for the recruiters and for the candidates.
That is really good. I mean, we are almost in the end. One question. What would you do if you were not working in the compliance industry?
I'm deeply interested in history, but as a younger... After school, I was a couple of years in the army, left the army then as a young army officer. And then I was the question, what should I study? And I want to study history because I'm deeply interested in history. But, you know, in history, you mainly are, difficult to obtain your goal to become a professor at university. That's difficult. And then you end up maybe doing something completely different. And I studied law because I thought law is gives you a lot of opportunities. I was happy to do so. And if I'm looking back, I still believe it's a great, very broad opening study. But my personal interest is deeply in history also. Yeah.
I think if you have the chance to have to meet somebody, who would you like to have a drink with? I mean, a tea or coffee or anything else?
Yeah, in this case, maybe a vodka, because it would be Mikhail Gorbachev. I would be so interested to understand his personal dilemma when he made a transition from the old Soviet Union with the Glasnost and Perestroika, which also, of course, brought the German unification as one of the results, but also brought a lot of dilemmas and topics, because everything was changed. And I would be so interested to know about his personal dilemmas, the pressure he had, about the ethical dilemmas, about the risks, also the personal risks Mikhail Gorbachev had. I believe he's one of the most, bravest people potentially in history, because he did something, and I think he believed in it, which changed the whole history. And I would be hugely interested about how did he feel about it in his dark moments and in the lonely nights. This would be Mr. Gorbachev for me.
Really, really interesting. Really interesting. The dilemma, still talking about dilemmas. That's really interesting. Klaus, thank you very much for your really interesting topics. I would say very, very, very interesting, because I go with you, hopefully, to the next step, doing more in RegTechs. I hope so.
Absolutely. That's definitely a joint effort. I really enjoyed the podcast. Thank you so much for all your efforts, Erkan, and hope the people who listen to it will find it interesting as well.
I hope so. Thank you.
Stay well. Thank you.